This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up, it's the 28th annual Indiana University Northwest Forum on Child Abuse and Neglect. Yes, 28. There have been that many of them since they've been started, and the fellow who got all this started is with us to talk about the latest one coming up here. We have with us today Professor Rick Hugg, as he's known by many of the students and faculty members, his colleagues. He has been the organizer of this event since 1991, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you.
Well, give us an idea for starters here, when you got started on this project back in 1991 with the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, did you realize it was going to be going on now for 28 years?
No, we did not. But of course, child abuse and neglect has been a problem before and continues to be a problem. The School of Public and Environmental Affairs had a what we call Public Affairs Day or Public Workers Day. And the idea was to salute those who are involved in public service. And this was just one of the ways. Mm-hmm. But from the beginning, we've always had great partners from the community. We've had the Indiana Department of Child Services and its predecessor and lots of organizations around the community that helped us plan. To this day, it is something that we come together and we plan this event. It's not part of any regular organization, but it is a community collaborative effort started like we said back in the year in the 90s in 91. Back then, I think it was a little different. I think back then, child abuse prevention had a lot to do with holding vigils and focusing on the problem of abuse and neglect and raising awareness that abuse and neglect was out there. These days, we focus more on prevention. We talk about things that can be done so that children never enter the child welfare system, things to improve the lives of children. And that's more the focus these days than it was in those early days.
Now, I know that this year's program theme is entitled Adverse Childhood Experiences, Trauma, Resilience, and Hope. It's a very long title for talking about this, but a lot of these topics are certainly all related, obviously, within the overall subject of child abuse and neglect. How did this topic theme for this year come about?
Well, over the last few years, I think we're picking up on a trend nationally. The first one, Adverse Childhood Experiences, is usually abbreviated ACEs. So right. We have our among the folks who are very familiar with what's going on in child welfare. It's just ACEs, trauma, resilience, and hope. ACEs are as it says, adverse childhood experiences. And research has shown that children who have adverse childhood experiences, and there are 10 of them, things like having to leave the home, parents who have problems with alcohol, those sorts of things. The researchers found that there are serious implications for health in later lives from having ACEs. And it's been a theme of several recent forums talking about adverse childhood experiences and what we can do to do it. Trauma, again, the research has shown that trauma causes changes in the brain and seriously affects health outcomes on down the line. So ACEs and trauma. But the research is also showing resilience and hope. And we think our keynote speaker, Shenandoah Sheffalo, she is a survivor of the child welfare system who has done very well for herself and is now coming out and talking about the specific sorts of things that happened to her and how it affected her and how she has been able to come back and have a very rewarding and just a terrific life. She's an author and a speaker. She goes about helping people deal with the sorts of issues that she dealt with as a child. So we've got ACEs, trauma, resilience, and hope. And once again, hope is there because of people like Shenandoah Sheffalo, but also because of the brain science. The same brain science that talks about the effects of trauma on the brain is also showing that resilience and hope, the effects on the brain of good things happening. So We have scientific evidence that the sorts of things that we think are important for children, having a responsible adult in their lives, these are things that make a serious difference. And it can be shown down at the brain level that when good things happen to folks, they build resilience, and there is hope for folks who have experienced lots of trauma, have experienced lots of adverse childhood experiences.
Well, certainly in the case of Ms. Scheffalo, that's definitely the case. I know the information that kind of talks about the forum itself describes her as basically sharing a wholly dysfunctional journey through a childhood that is apparently was a very, very tough one for her. She had parents who had problems with drugs and with alcohol. And a lot of this, I would imagine, too, is related in many ways. Of course, it's still drugs to speak of it. But the problems of today, in particular with the opioid addiction crisis, probably heighten the problems of child abuse and neglect even more, don't they?
Yes, they do, and that is one of the things that has, in Indiana and many states, one of the increases in children entering the foster care system are a result of these sorts of problems, of the opioid crisis. It's a very serious thing, and Indiana has taken some steps to increase treatment options, very recently announcing some things, and it is a critical thing for communities to support the treatment facilities and to support families who are going through these sorts of things. We know that it's always better if children can stay with their parents, if it can be worked out so that they are in their familiar situations. It is always best if we can do that. It's not always possible, but and that has to do with one of the messages that we've had for many years, and the idea that it's everybody's responsibility to help make the lives of children better. And one way is to support and strengthen families who are dealing with raising children. Helping them out is a very important thing for communities to do, and it is something that we can all do.
I know there's many series of workshops that are set up, and this year certainly no exception with this 28th annual IUN Forum to deal with all of these different topics. You mentioned many of them in particular, too, but I find it very, very interesting that you focus a lot not only on the overall problems, but you actually get in, and some of these I know are going to be handled by Ms. Scheffalo and some other people as well, too, who are kind of facilitating the workshops this time, talking about some specific ways to deal with the problems and dealing in particular with working with young people that are going through these terrible experiences, unfortunately, but they're trying to help kind of find them to get them a way to find their way out of this too.
Yes, that's correct. The our keynoter, she by the way was worked as 20 for 20 years as a court administrator, and she saw kids coming into her court that had similar issues to what she had. And so she was inspired by that, and she became a coach. So she is a trained coach. And a lot of what she does, it's sort of a mentoring and coaching thing. And her workshop is helping without harming, a trauma-informed approach to coaching kids, teens, mm-hmm. and families. I think this is going to be one of the very popular workshops. She's going to talk about what she's learned about coaching and her particular insights in dealing with kids who have this particular problem, the trauma of being removed from their homes. Some of the other workshops, we have two workshops on human trafficking, one sort of introductory workshop, and one workshop that will feature the folks who are currently working with victims of human trafficking, so people in the criminal justice system and the human services system. That's an important sequence. We have a workshop on a very effective effort going on in Hammond, the No More Secrets. It's a sexual abuse prevention effort. There are all sorts of training going on in the schools around town. That's one of the others. We are looking at the Indiana system of care. We have a workshop on that. Mm-hmm. This is a particularly important group of folks who are working to be sure that there is an integrated system of care for the children who have behavioral health problems. It takes a lot to support families who have children with behavioral health problems, and this is a coalition of folks who are working to make sure that the care for these young people is seamless. And that's one of our newer workshops this year. We also, one of the things I guess I would want to highlight too is we have a documentary film that highlights sort of all of the research on how stress affects the body and about how there is hope. And we think that it will over time change the way we approach the whole idea of dealing with stress. It will promote trauma-informed care, the idea that treatment people need to ask the question, what happened to this child, rather than something, why is this kid doing all of these things? We find that when we say, what happened to this child, when we get at the types of trauma that the child has experienced, it provides good insights into what would work for that particular child. So trauma-informed care is something that we featured in many of our recent workshops, and it's something that this particular video is called Resilience, the Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope, and we're featuring that in one of our workshops.
I also noticed, too, that one of the topics for one of the workshops in the afternoon session deals with trying to help young people and people in general, I guess, with the issues that are related to sexual and gender identity, which is not a new topic to be sure, but it seems that it's become much more into the forefront these days. And it's interesting that it'd be taken up here. That's going to be, I'm sure, a very popular workshop as well.
Yes, well, we've had this one for several years, and it is always one that draws interest. It is a very important topic, and we're talking about the young people particularly have serious issues with working out problems of gender identity, and we think that it's important to support families, to let them know that there are other families and others out dealing with the gender identity issues. And we try to provide a place where people can get together and talk about those things and get into the kinds of groups that can help ease those sorts of transitions.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is the 28th annual Indiana University Northwest Forum on Child Abuse and Neglect. And it's going to happen Friday, by the way. It's an all-day affair starting at about 9 in the morning until about 4 in the afternoon. And it's going to happen this year at the new Arts and Sciences building, which is along Broadway there on the edge of the Gary campus. And I know that you've asked for some pre-registration ahead of time because you want to be sure that you have enough pencils and workbooks and everything else, that, so to speak, that you're going to have for everybody who's going to be in participation. But are they accepting on-site registration, too, for somebody that may want to come in at the last minute, so to speak, on Friday?
Yes, we do have on-site registrations, and the best way is to enter the door the new Arts and Sciences Theater is located on the east side of Broadway, mm-hmm. and the 34th Avenue entrance is the best way. You're welcome to walk in and register. We have free lunches for those that are pre-registered. We will probably we may very well run out of lunches, but you're welcome to come and take part. Walk in anytime and join us for the day.
And we should note, too, that there are two sections of workshops that are planned. As you mentioned, some of the basic workshops, I'm sure, come up first in the sessions that will happen after Ms. Sheffalo finishes her address to everybody there, as well as in the sessions in the afternoon. So I guess you can probably, if you get the information, you can make a choice whether you would stay in for the morning or the afternoon or for the entire day, I suppose.
That's correct. Welcome to come to just see. Some folks may want to just see the keynote speaker. Some may want to just see the video in the afternoon. So the plenary session starts at 9, goes to 10:30. Workshops from 10:45 to noon. afternoon workshops from 1 to 2:15 and a closing plenary at 2:30.
And we should mention, too, that's a very special event, too. And in fact, I guess there's going to be another one of the series of awards that have been handed out, which happens to be in your name. It was named for you, Dr. Richard Hugg, or Rick Hugg, the Cherish the Children Award, as it's been handed out by the folks at Prevent Child Abuse Lake County. So that's coming up at the end of the day. And also, I understand, too, there are going to be some special surprise guests. And I suppose it wouldn't be fair to ask you who they are because it's supposed to be a surprise.
That's correct. I will say that in the past, we have had the different groups, singing groups from the local community who have come by to show their stuff to our group. One of the things that we think is very important with this event, there are some very, very dedicated people. They are the people who attend, in addition to other folks from the general public. But these are child welfare workers. They work very hard. They have very, very difficult jobs. And we intend this particular event each year to recognize their work, to talk about best practices, help them improve their skills, but also to provide some things that maybe provide a little bit of relief at the end of a stressful day. So that last session is intended to help raise their spirits and help them go back out and do the very difficult things that they do every day, knowing that there are a lot of folks that are with them and that the whole community does support their effort to support and strengthen families.
20th annual IU Northwest Forum on Child Abuse and Neglect is coming up on Friday, an all-day affair that's going to happen again inside the new Arts and Sciences building on the IU Northwest campus. It is part, by the way, of the IU Northwest School of Public and Environmental Affairs Public Service Month that happens. In fact, it kind of is the closing event for the entire month that has happened during the month of April. And Professor Rick Hugg, thank you very much for spending time to tell us about the topic and talk about the folks that are going to be speaking in the workshops and in particular the very important and very well-known speaker who's going to be doing the keynote address here. Thank you very much. The best of luck to everybody that's involved in the project for this coming Friday, and thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you very much, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Before we go on, as mentioned, we often talk about the programs that happen at Valparaiso University as well. Pathways to Purpose is the speaker series that's underway right now. They were going to have a speaker, a gentleman named Stephen Lehman, to come in for the event today, but he has had to cancel his appearance. Mr. Lehman is a 2009 grad of Valparaiso University, and he is very much involved in a program called Invest in Innovation, which is based out of the University of Chicago Innovation Fund. And I'm sure that they'll have him back to speak again sometime in the future, but he was not unable to be able to be a part of the Pathways to Purpose program for today. And speaking of programs, it's time once again for Green Fleet Radio. And here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. Trey Wadsworth. He's the Director of Transportation for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Trey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carl.
Well, I know NERPC is the Metropolitan Planning Organization, or MPO, for Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, but what should our listeners know about what MPOs do?
MPOs were created by the federal government back in the 60s to help make sure that local priorities were reflected in transportation investments in their areas. So we really work with all of our local communities to make sure that the federal transportation dollars we receive in the region are used effectively and towards the priorities that really are reflected by what our customers need.
You know, Trey, I know a lot of people, you know, work, all of our communities work with NERPC, and I know that you're relatively new to NERPC, and why don't you tell our listeners where you're from?
I'm originally from upstate New York. I started my career in Boston, Massachusetts, working for the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. Got some great training there, and I'm using it here in northwestern Indiana now.
And we're so glad you're here. And so when you talk about planning initiatives, what kind of planning initiatives are underway at NERPC?
Right now, we're kicking off the development of our next long-range plan. Every 4 years, we're required by our federal partners to update our long-range plan. It looks out at least 20 years into the future to see what what kind of investments into our transportation system are needed. So we're going to get underway on updating the plan, and we're going to look out to 2050 this time.
So as we talk about, what kind of things guide the development of this 2050 plan?
In large part, there are some federal requirements that guide it, some of the national planning goals, but as most importantly are the priorities of the region from the people we hear from.
And so what are some of the issues that the 2050 plan will address?
Yeah. So we are going to be actually taking a very interesting approach to this plan using what we call a qualitative scenario planning process. And that sounds a lot very wonky, but it allows us to envision different types of futures that we might experience. So we're going to investigate different influences and trends that the transportation system and other issues like the environment and economic development are currently experiencing. So for instance, one of the things we will look at as an influence is technology.
Sure.
And how that's changing the transportation system. For instance, our partners in Chicago have been doing a lot of research about how Uber and Lyft are impacting the transit system. Here in the region, it could be very different for us because they could connect people to opportunities in a way that we currently can't with the transit systems we have today. But trying to understand those influences and understand how they'll impact our future. Another one is demography. Who lives in the region and how is it changing?
A lot of change going on. And I know, you know, all the NERPC meetings are publicly open. And, you know, we would suggest that, you know, folks get involved with some of this public planning. So how can people actually participate in this plan?
Yep. So we are actually underway now on reaching out to folks to participate in the long range plan. We have four different periods in which we're going to be working with the public to set the priorities for this plan. The first engagement effort is going to be setting the vision for the plan and trying to make sure that we've got the direction that we want collectively as a region, and then we'll be doing surveys, public meetings, and so we hope folks can participate in those.
Sure, and how can people find out about NERPC and some of the other great programs that you're working on?
One of the best ways is social media, of course. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter as well. You can sign up for our emails and if you can, come in person.
Absolutely. So as we talk about the future of Northwest Indiana and we talk about, you know, some of these trends, is there a model that we follow here with NERPC? I know there's not a perfect model or perfect scenario, but is there a model?
One of the best ways to do that, I think, is to look at some of our peer regions around the nation. There are some instances where Northwest Indiana is in many ways connected to a larger metropolitan area like Chicago. So looking at some of those other examples, there's a region in southeastern Massachusetts that's very connected to Boston, but has the same kind of composition that we have here with smaller cities spread across a region. So seeing how they handle the issues with being next to a big city, as well as having a whole bunch of little smaller cities in the region and connecting all those people and jobs.
A huge undertaking. You know, as just recently, I know that the president in Congress and Senate passed the omnibus bill, and you know I know that there's a big influence on improving infrastructure. And how will that impact Northwest Indiana?
Because we principally do program federal investments. Funding for transportation. We're looking forward to those resources coming into the region and working with our communities to identify the best projects to make for our people.
And then as we look forward to the 2050 analysis, what are some of the things that you might anticipate that might be coming out that is different than now?
Potentially looking at different partnerships that we can build with different organizations throughout the region, as well as really focusing in on some of the major investments that are about to get underway, like the South Shoreline Extension and double tracking. Where can we best harness those investments to make an impact for the region in terms of jobs and connectivity to those jobs and new and great places to live?
Absolutely. And again, I think it's an exciting time to be involved with transportation planning, and we're excited to be a partner with NERPC, and we look forward to all these different activities that are going to continue to happen. But as we come to the end of our program, Trey, is there any closing thoughts that you would have for any of our listeners and for the future transportation here in Northwest Indiana?
I just really hope everyone everyone can participate in the planning process. You know, for me as a professional in planning, I love it, of course. So I'm a nerd about transportation planning. I hope everyone else can find their inner nerd to join us.
Well, again, I think it's just that is that, you know, we've seen our participation, our public participation in a lot of these meetings going up, you know, the activities with social media and just the things, you know, sometimes people can't make meetings, but there's other opportunities for them to be involved in this planning process. So yes. We're excited that you're here. Welcome to Northwest Indiana. We look forward to working with you. Look forward to having you back on the show very shortly to give our listeners updates on what's going on with NERPC. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Trey Wadsworth, Director of Transportation for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And if you happen to miss this, you can catch these in the podcast form on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Or you can also hear Green Fleet Radio podcasts on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The debate about whether a piece of wetland not far from the Little Calumet River in Gary is a suitable home for a solid waste materials recovery facility is still under discussion. And we have the participants for you now. First, from Maya Energy, LLC, the company that wants to build the MRF, as it's called, along 35th Avenue. James Ventura is a former East Chicago City Councilman who's the principal of Maya Energy, LLC. He was on Regionally Speaking back in early March.
Maya Energy is proposing to build a what we call a material recycling facility.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We will take residential municipal solid waste, and we're also going to take construction and demolition debris. We are not accepting any medical or hazardous waste. I want to make that very clear. Okay. What the process is proven, we're using a company that's built over 400 facilities worldwide. Basically, we take your typical paper, plastic, cardboard that's in residential, non-hazardous waste, bring it into the plant. The truck drops it on a concrete floor, and immediately we start separating using equipment and technology, including what we call optical sorters.
Mm-hmm.
That is the latest to separate your high-end value paper, plastic, cardboard. Anything that's of lower value might be some paper that's got ketchup or contaminated. It goes to a different section of the facility where it's shredded and turned into what we call shredded paper, plastic, cardboard, and we call that a refuse derived fuel.
Mm-hmm. What is that material going to go? The material that isn't clean enough or in good enough quality to be able to use and send out as recyclable.
Okay. That material, Chris, will go into an industrial user, typically a power plant. We'll use it in our dedicated boilers to make power.
So it does get another use. It may not be not high-grade fuel, obviously, not as good as coal or something like that even, or even natural gas, but it will work as fuel in some facility, I take it.
Well, the RDF is going to be very clean, and it's a quality fuel, let me put it that way. It's a very good fuel.
Now, you mentioned about trucks bringing material in. What types of trucks are typically going to be able to bring this material to be sorted there at the facility?
Well, Chris, we're basically looking at what we call tipper trailers.
Mm-hmm.
Probably less number of, let's say, city, municipal solid waste, garbage trucks will come in. But basically, the majority would be what we call tipper trailer trucks, which are bigger. They look like kind of like a semi.
Mm-hmm.
And they hold about 25 tons per load.
I know that typically that we see some materials dropped off at sorting facilities kind of like this or what you're proposing. And a lot of times a waste hauler will use a clean, but a dedicated truck that either is one that picks up from the front or picks up from the back, however that the truck is made to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that material then is opened up and that material is then pushed out onto the tipping floor, the area where you're going to sort. So you're going to have more larger, more dedicated vehicles or containers, at least, to bring this material in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, it'll be a mixture. I would say probably 70% tippers, probably about 30 or 20% more to the residential you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah, the more residential trucks that pick up the
so it's like they're not garbage trucks. That is to say, they carry trash, although trucks like those do. But mm-hmm. these are, as I say, they're cleaned out. They're dedicated to handle recyclable material. So this way you get this cleaner material as you can expect to get.
Exactly. Yeah. We're going to be a flexible facility. We will be able to take recyclables. Those are called recyclables, mm-hmm. curbside recyclables. Definitely we'll be able to take.
Well, we know that some of the companies here in Northwest Indiana do use those types of trucks to pick up curbside recycling. And mm-hmm. so I imagine you will get that material in. But the idea that it all comes in, all mixed up together, when it's, we'll say, plopped on the floor, so to speak, of the facility mm-hmm. that you're building there.
Well, like I said, we'll take single stream, those are recyclables, and mm-hmm. we also take mix,
right?
Municipal solid waste. So, but we have the technology, Chris, to be able to separate everything.
Well, tell us about that, about when you get mm-hmm. things all mixed together, although it's clean material brought in the front door, so mm-hmm. to speak, and you have to sort it out. Tell us about what this the sorting is going to be like.
Yeah, well, typically that process will start with a conveyor and a grappler will pick up the load and put it on a metered conveyor. It'll go up the conveyor, be a horizontal conveyor, and we'll have personnel there trained to look at what we're trying to get out of the waste stream, which would be, let's say, the high-end cardboard, plastic, paper. Mm-hmm. They're trained, and they'll grab it, whatever they're particularly looking for. They throw it in the bin. The rest will be separated by what we call trommels, separated into size. The optical sorters will shoot a light into, let's say, the plastic bottles. And the high-grade ones, it'll just kick it off to the side. Mm-hmm. So it's the technology is there today.
So you've got the mechanical sorting at the very end of the conveyor belt, so to speak, and that's where you get the material coming in to be able to sort a little finer material, I suppose, and then get that out. Now, once everything is sorted, the people that do the picking off the line and put mm-hmm. that into the bins, how is all that together how is all that put together to be able to send out to the end user, to the company that wants the material at the other end?
Yeah, what we'll do is we will take it from the bins and we will take it directly to like a baler,
mm-hmm.
okay? Anything that's quality and inspected that fits, let's say, the end user, for example, like a Pratt, does envelope a razor.
Oh, yeah,
like
a paper mill or a mill that uses either makes paper
exactly,
or makes cardboard.
Exactly, and we've met with Pratt already. That's
oh,
one of
really?
The companies that we have met.
I was going to ask if you've lined up your end users, as they call them, in the business, the companies like Pratt Industries and places where they do take in the plastic materials or the other metals or anything like that might get sorted out.
Yeah, Chris, yeah, we do. We have a big company lined up already mm-hmm. With us already. Matter of fact, we're under an agreement. And like I said, you know, those are the higher end valuable recyclables. The lower end, you know, like I stated before, we will take it, shred it, and also bale that for fuel. Now, mm-hmm. the good thing is this, that the Lake County Solid Waste, they did what they call a resolution in 2016,
right,
which says zero waste landfill.
Yeah, that's the efforts that they're making now, that the goals that they're working
for. Exactly,
yeah.
And this is very important. We're lined up with that zero waste resolution. Mm-hmm. Also, the state has a mandate that you have to recycle 50%. So, you know, right now, I think our facility will do about 90% diversion mm-hmm. to the landfill.
Okay. Let's talk about the process that you're going through right now. Mm-hmm. The facilities, the construction facility, you say, is getting underway. You have to have special permits from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Tell us about the permit that you're seeking and how that process is coming along right now.
Yes. The two... I would say most important, they're all important, but the two most important permits from the state would be what they call a air/construction permit that would allow you to build the facility.
Mm-hmm.
Then your second one is called the solid waste processing that you need to operate the facility. We've got the first one already. That was tough to get. It took us over a year, a good year, and now we're working on getting that second one.
Mm-hmm. I understand, you know, that the public comment period just ended, as a matter of fact, on the consideration of the solid waste processing facility permit. So you're getting to the end of that process, or relatively soon, I would imagine. You'll be hearing from Indianapolis on that pretty soon?
Correct, yeah. We expect to have some probably in the next couple of weeks or so.
When you turn in your paperwork, so mm-hmm. to speak, the application for that permit, the second one, you have certain standards that you have to follow, I would imagine, for cleanliness, to make sure that there are no No bugs or critters around. How about for things like noise, and particularly with all the trucks that are going to be coming through that particular area?
Yeah, well, things like noise is more of a local ordinance. Mm-hmm. Okay, what the state looks for very carefully, what waste characterization that we're bringing in, what we're going to do with it, where is it going to go with the end user, if it's hazardous, non-hazardous, does it got, you know, paint on it or no paint? They're very strict, so we went through a real detailed process, Chris, for that.
Working with the city of Gary and getting things started initially, had, of course, zoning changes and things that had to be followed, which is, have already happened because you're at that point now where you're getting the facility built. How are you working with your neighbors in the area, so to speak? They're on 45th Avenue. Have you had a chance to talk with them and explain to them in more detail what this is like? And are you going to be able to continue working with your neighbors as the facility is built and in operation?
Well, Chris, what we did was we went through an extensive permitting, zoning process where we met right from the beginning. We met with the city officials to make sure that they were on board and that they were supportive of the project. We did a lot of design engineering work. We did traffic studies for that project. It's not an easy project. It's a complicated project. But we went through all the legal process to get to where we're at. And we had, you know, support from the city. That's the first thing we did. Mm-hmm. It's very important.
What kind of help are you getting from the city of Gary, for example, since you're going to be located off the edge of the city road? It's probably going to need improvements, or it's going to need some expansion, I would imagine, to handle all that that traffic out there. Are they going to be able to help you out?
Well, Chris, we never asked the city for any incentives. Mm-hmm. Or we ask them for any help. We're basically going to try to, talk to the state maybe, see if there's something that Gary could get as far as that road
right.
to fix it. And we're going to see what we can do also to help.
So you'll ask for help from NDOT or for the,
exactly.
the state agencies if they can help improve the road or whatever to
exactly.
make it better.
So. And we're going to do whatever we can also, mm-hmm. you know, as a company.
When you get a project like this started, and you say it's very, very ambitious project, a very big mm-hmm. project, we know that you are taking in, you mentioned some construction and demolition waste. For a moment, briefly describe what that kind of material is. And mm-hmm. let me add to the question, too. We know the city of Gary wants to have some kind of construction and demolition drop-off location where materials can be brought in from the houses that are going to be demolished. Will you be able to take on some of that material, too?
Chris, absolutely. Early in our meetings with the city of Gary, that was brought to our attention that if we, you know, build the facility, it would be nice for us to take the C&D. And we are. We're going to take it. We're open to working with the city of Gary, and we definitely can accept.
And I guess C&D, as we've described it here, that's basically typically what comes out of a demolished structure of some kind, whether it's wood or plastics or metals or things like that. That just gets all bunched together because it's whenever they rip something apart, they just dump it into a truck, and you end up with a truckload of something. That's where it has to be sorted out too, right?
Yeah, exactly. You got your residential, commercial. I mean, basically in the residential, you have wood, you have concrete, you have some cardboard, you have some metals, and shingles, of course. And what we'll do is we have the technology, again, to be able to sort that out.
Mm-hmm. That is James Ventura, who represents Maya Energy, LLC. And coming up, the other side of the story about a MRF in Gary, that's in just a moment. These are the representatives of the folks who are in turn involved in handling the matters of the issue of what's concerned for the residents and the people affected by the proposal. Sam Henderson, who is an attorney for the HEC, the Hoosier Environmental Council, he is working with the businesses and also the Steel City Academy, which is a school which is right across the street from the site of the proposed materials resource recovery facility.
We have a number of concerns, but the biggest underlying concern is that this is not an appropriate location for this facility, mm-hmm. Especially with one of the increasingly few schools in Gary located right across the street, and also that it's really unclear that this is an appropriate facility anywhere, in the sense that it doesn't really appear to be fulfilling an existing need for solid mm-hmm. waste, and that that creates a lot of problems with the sustainability of a project, because a lot of times when you have a solid waste facility that isn't commercially viable or isn't fulfilling a definite need in the system, that creates an opportunity for a lot of things to go wrong.
I'd like to take the opportunity here while we have a chance to talk in a little more detail about the concerns, especially from what the HEC has seen. Tell us first off here, what is the procedure now? This is going before the staff members at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management.
That's right.
And even Mr. Ventura mentioned in detail about the fact that they have a pre-operating permit, or at least a permit to be able to build something initially or get things started first. That's the first procedure that they are going through and with the state, and they've gone through that now. But now they're going through the actual operating permit process. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I guess perhaps I don't see the process in quite the way that Mr. Ventura does. Uh-huh. They have received an air permit that allows them from the standpoint of the air quality regulations that allow them to construct their facility. But they are not allowed to construct a solid waste processing facility until they have received this permit that they are seeking now, which is the solid waste permit. Mm-hmm. And as you said, that is currently gone to the state regulators, to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. And at this point, the public comment period is closed, so we are waiting to see what they think.
Well, that period closed about a week ago, I guess, or not very long.
March 12th. Yeah.
Tell us, if you will, what kind of case you've made before the Indiana Department of Environmental Management about this particular project, and please give us an idea in particular what are the concerns not only of the Hoosier Environmental Council, but as well as the residents and Steel City Academy, which is the school we're talking about right across the street from this project.
Yeah. Well, we were very pleased and glad to be able to present a joint comment that was not only from the Hoosier Environmental Council, but from many local residents and local business owners, local religious leaders, and above all, the faculty and staff of the Steel City Academy. So we've presented a united front, and we've raised quite a few issues. Some of the key ones are that they haven't met some of the formal requirements, such as demonstrating an Indiana solid waste need for this facility, or showing that they have either ownership or a leasehold on the property where they want to build. Both of those are explicitly required under state law, and in our view, they have not met those requirements. And underlying that, of course, are the deeper concerns that this is not an appropriate facility, and it may not be operated in accordance with the law. And so that's why those formal defects are especially concerning, and why we believe that IDEM should reject the permit.
Let's take up the question first here about the ownership or a lease, at least on and how this is supposed to be set up here officially, based on what the state environmental rules are for whoever owns the property or has control of the property for any project like this. Tell us about this particular site and the concerns there.
Okay, so this site was taken over by the state from a private owner in 1979, I believe. And it was deeded by the state to the Little Calumet River Basin Development Commission in 1981 when the commission was set up.
That was through for the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, right?
That's right. Okay. Yeah.
And it's turned over now to the Little Calumet River Basin Redevelopment Commission, the full title. Mm-hmm. And what is this site? I guess we know what kind of it's along 35th Avenue, but what is this site so close to the river, and why? And it's understandable why the DNR turned it over to the commission for safekeeping, I suppose, or operation, or for at least for use in the future.
It was turned over as part of the Little Calumet Commission holds a lot of the land all along the river, and this is part of that. Part of the lot is inside the levee. Part of it is outside the levee. Where they want to build is just outside the levee, or I should say, away from the river.
Right along 35th Avenue. Directly off the street.
And it's currently used for low impact farming. I think at the moment there are soybeans on it.
Mm-hmm.
and some trees. It's just sort of your basic farm field, and it's been in that shape essentially for at least 30 years.
One of the other concerns that you mentioned here is the weather. There is truly a need for this particular type of facility to handle this type of solid waste, or at least solid waste in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're the kind of facility that's been applied for here, which is to create a refuse-derived fuel, is the kind of facility that was very popular in the 1980s. When there was a perceived need for substitutes for coal, for things you can burn instead of coal in a power plant or a steel mill. And, you know, the world has kind of moved on from that. Burning coal.
Isn't that in a way very similar to the original plans for even the city of Indianapolis to have their facility, their incinerator built in downtown Indianapolis, was to take in all this trash basically to come in and be able to create steam out of it. And that's the steam that was going to be pumped through the downtown Indianapolis buildings.
Yeah. And in fact, the Covanta facility in Indianapolis is currently the only waste-to-energy facility of this kind anywhere in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. If I guess the concern comes up here is not only whether this is the proper use for the land, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Since you all are familiar with the solid waste needs and disposal needs of the state of Indiana and in Northwest Indiana in particular, what type of facilities does the Hoosier Environmental Council support or endorse, maybe, to be able to deal with some of the issues of the waste that comes into Northwest Indiana and the uses to find homes for recyclables or, mm-hmm. I guess in another sense, too, homes for construction demolition waste that we know that would certainly come from the city of Gary. They've proposed a similar site of sorts to handle the material the contractors can bring in from tearing down all the dilapidated buildings in Gary.
Mm-hmm. We're certainly very much in favor of recycling and in favor of reuse. We're very excited about some of the work that's been done, for example, by the Delta Institute in terms of repurposing demolition materials.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't want to stand in the way of that. However, there's a real concern whenever you're dealing with essentially an unrestricted general waste flow that you're going to end up dealing with things that are not safe and ending up with the kind of side effects that we've unfortunately seen around Gary and East Chicago many times over. So there's kind of a high threshold of persuasion there.
I know that My Energy LLC, in having to turn in their application for this solid waste facility permit with IDEM, they have to state in many terms how they're going to deal with such things as pests, vectors, as it's called, I guess, in the commercial world, as well as dealing with not only smells, but also with the potential for hazardous waste that could come in and how that's going to be handled if the facility were built. How does the HEC stand on some of these things that are brought forth in the permit application?
Well, we're very concerned about the lack of experience in the team that is actually standing behind this project. I mean, anyone can write a persuasive explanation of how you're going to handle all of these issues, whether it's smell or it's rodents or anything else. But actually running a facility that handles, in this case, 2,400 tons of solid waste a day is something that requires a significant amount of expertise. And when it's handled by people who don't have that expertise, again, the risks of something going wrong become much higher.
I know that you don't directly represent the folks at Steel City Academy, but you're working very closely with the owners, the principal at the school, as well as, I guess, in a way, the students. They're very, very vocal about this. They're a very, very activistic stand-up right now, I understand.
Yeah, it has been really impressive to see what the students at Steel City Academy are doing.
They've had an opportunity, I guess, to send a response of their own, haven't they, down to Indianapolis during the public comment period?
Yes. On March 12th, the principal and some students hand-delivered, I believe, approximately 500 public comments, largely handwritten, to IDEM.
Now, you mentioned the public comment period has ended, and it's now up to IDEM, and I guess more the staffers in particular. Tell us how that's handled from that point on, and how they kind of go through the decision making process on their end that you're familiar with.
Well, it's I think anytime you have a high profile project like this, there's going to be a lot of involvement from several levels. There's a permit manager who handles, you know, the basic mechanics, and then there's a section chief, and there are deputy commissioners, and there's ultimately Commissioner Bruno Piggott who is running the show.
Right.
And I expect at some level all of those people will be involved in examining these comments and deciding what their ultimate decision is going to be.
Now, what typically kind of timetable do they usually have when they get an average permit, so to speak, that comes in the door there in Indianapolis and gets sorted out there at IDM before some decision's made and some permit comes back to who applied for it?
I think under normal circumstances, it might be 1 or 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, my understanding is that the IDEM staff are actually required to read and respond to each public comment they've received. And since they have received several hundred, that may slow the process down somewhat.
And I'm sure that the bureaucrats in Indianapolis at the state office building aren't happy with that, but that's part of the job. It comes with the territory, I understand. So what does the Hoosier Environmental Council, are they able to do at this point now that the public comment period is over? Is it just a case you're watching this very closely, or is there any more that you can do from the organization standpoint?
Well, we're continuing to talk to people in the community. We're talking to local government and other people who may have some influence on the process or different aspects of the process. You know, the Little Calumet Commission still has some say in how this shapes out because this is their land. The city of Gary may still have something to say about this process. But as far as the state permit, we're primarily in a wait and see situation.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of first off here of the city of Gary, since mm-hmm. We know and we've mentioned before, and even we brought up in that conversation with Mr. Ventura that the city of Gary is trying to deal with their own construction mm-hmm. demolition waste problems. As we said, they have many buildings they wish to have demolished, but they have no place to stage the material the contractors would bring over from a mm-hmm. group of houses in some neighborhood, be it Glen Park or any place for that matter in Gary, and then for that material to be properly disposed of, is there anything that there's much can be done right now, or is it still a wait and see situation for the city of Gary about this?
Well, I'm not really privy to their decision making.
Right.
It is my understanding from the mayor that they do not wish to use the Maya Energy facility. There's certainly a problem there, but I think where things get sticky is that these situations that are proposed, whether it's the landfill that was proposed under HB 1318 or this Maya Energy facility, yes, we have a problem with waste from Gary, but each of these facilities would be primarily handling waste that's not from Gary.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we're really going to look for solutions to Gary-specific waste problems, we've got to look for something that is narrowly tailored to what Gary needs.
And finally, Sam, what can we tell the folks at Steel City Academy and the neighbors that own businesses mm-hmm. along that area?
Well, I would say everyone has done a great job, and we're going to keep fighting.
That is Sam Henderson, who is an attorney for the Hoosier Environmental Council, talking about the application that's been put in to create a materials recovery facility in Gary. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. Tomorrow it's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll have with you from the Indianapolis Star, Matt Tully, and from the Post Tribune, we have Carol Carlson, and from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Rob Earnshaw, to talk about the stories that they've worked on or the columns they've put together, in Matt's case, for their particular publications. Hope you'll join us tomorrow for that.